Hello there and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast. I'm the real host, Joe Devine, and this is another episode of Joe Made Me Watch, the mini-series where I pick a film, force Adam to watch it, and then hear him talk about it. Today's film is the most recent of the bunch, actually, and one that we've already talked about a little bit on this podcast before. It's 2025's One Battle After Another. That's right, one of the big films of last year, one of the big winners at the Oscars, directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, starring Leo DiCaprio, Sean F. Penn, Benicio Del Toro. I mean, I'm sure most people listening have seen the film, but I will quickly read the IMDb blurb anyway. When their enemy resurfaces after 16 years, a group of ex-revolutionaries reunite to rescue the daughter of one of their own. There we go. So, I guess the main question is, why is this on the list of Joe Made Me Watch? And it's a good question, because many of the other films are either films that Adam hasn't seen before, or they're older films that I've wanted Adam to watch for a long time. Adam has seen this film, I think, possibly twice. It might just be once. I think he might have seen it twice, though. Maybe not. Maybe this is the second time. We'll find out. That'll be the first thing he says. He'll be like, actually, I've seen it 7 times, Joe. You know, that'll be the first thing we hear when we cut to him in a minute. But why do I want him to watch it? Well, largely because we had a difference of opinion about this film. I really loved it. It's one of the only films I've ever gone to see twice in the cinema. It really made an impact on me the first time I saw it. And then I took my wife to go and see it as well. I just thought it was great. I was completely gripped by the intro. An intro which I have found later seems to be divisive with audiences. Some people really liked it, some people don't. But I love that. The whole sort of first 15 minutes, which is set, you know, before the 16 years later moment. It feels really exciting and it feels like a brilliant way to start a film. It also felt like it came out at the perfect moment where the world within the film felt realistically like a world that we might, you know, soon live in or maybe do now. So it chimed with me for all of those reasons, as well as just being an exciting sort of, I thought it was a thrill ride. I don't think Adam thinks of it that way, but I thought of it as a thrill ride. So that's the main reason. I want him to reconsider it, to watch it again, having had a bit of a break from it, and also a bit of a break from all of the people who were, you know, pouring praise on it, because I know that Adam doesn't like it when other people like a film. He's going to hate that. He's also going to say in this episode, at various points, I think he'll say, I came back to it open-minded. But actually then, all those things that Joe said in the intro, they are the reason that I can't, that's the voice of the people. I can't take it seriously after I hear those things, you know. That's what everyone thinks, isn't it? I think you'll hear that. Let me think of other things he might say so that I can say them before he does. He's going to say the Sean Penn character's ridiculous, which is fair because that is the worst part of the film. You can definitely do away, this is spoilers by the way, but you can definitely do away with Sean Penn coming back at the end. I've no need for that. Although I do quite like the how overtly sort of comic book level racist that the antagonists in the film are. I think that's used to good effect. And I absolutely love the exciting chase scene at the end on the big windy road. It's really fun. It really got me going. I thought the film starts at a pace and ends at a pace. And for me, despite it being quite long, because it is a 2 hour, 41 minute film, and I know Adam won't like that, it really flies by to me. I think something he'll definitely say is that Leo's good in it, and that, you know, he's a Leo guy and he likes Leo. I think he will like the moments where, in fact, I think he might have said this after the first time we watched it as well, those moments that you see some of them in the trailer where Leo's on the phone trying to get information about where his daughter is, and he's sort of, and he's shouting at one of the revolutionaries on the phone. Those moments are, you know, the kind of the most comedic in the film. I think he liked those. I also quite like the rapport that Leo and Benicio del Toro have. I think that's good fun as well. But anyway, I want to see what nearly a year has done to Adam's opinion, whether it's changed it at all. And so I suppose without further ado, I'll hand over to him. I will just say that towards the end of the episode, you'll come back to me and you'll hear my prediction for a rating out of 10 that Adam gives this movie. So there you go. That's why I've picked it. I hope you liked it, Adam. I hope you enjoyed it more this time. Can't wait to hear what you have to say. Here we go.
Actually, Joe, I think you'll find I have only seen it once, just as a point of order there, just the one time at the cinema. So, yes, just it's good to clear that up. I don't know why you thought I saw it two times. I'll stop doing that. A less needly intro from Mr. Joe Devine there. Hey, thanks, Joe. Thanks for not, for I'd say, a little lack of needle about my one battle after another thoughts. Yeah, just saw it the once, and I was in no hurry to rewatch it, really. So it was great that this series came up. And it was the first film that came to mind, I think, for you. You thought, yeah, let's stick it on Adam Richmondo, and let's get him back on PTA, and let him reconsider his opinion, which I tend to need to do with a PTA. That's what I like to call Paul Thomas Anderson. I think all your self-respecting cineasts, they say PTA after they've you first say Paul Thomas Anderson on the first mention, and then every other mention after that, it's PTA. So, like, yeah, for Magnolia, I remember seeing Magnolia at the cinema when I was, I think, 18, and I struggled with it. That's a very long movie, and I didn't get it. It didn't capture me. There's some great bits in that. Obviously, I love the chat about that movie was how great Tom Cruise was, and I found myself just watching these cross-cutting stories, and it was a bit out of my grasp. I would then watch that maybe 5 years later, quite a few years later, and then realize, oh no, this is a great movie. I love these short stories that all intertwine. I have seen some Robert Altman now. I get what's going on. So I assume that would be the case with One Battle After Another. And this is the key point, really. I've sort of jumped the gun because... It's not all about... But a lot of it, for me, about seeing a movie is... It's about expectation and desire. And I want to be... Invariably, I want something from a movie. If it's a comedy, I want it to make me laugh. If it's an action movie, I want it to thrill me and amaze me. If it's a drama, I want it to make me feel things and empathise with characters and situations. I mean, really, when I watch a movie at all, I want to forget who I am. You know, I want to forget that I exist, that there's like a little me in my head. Those are the requirements. And that's complicated when you're watching the film of a director you've grown up with, or a director that you have any kind of connection to. And so rewatching this really made me like think about why I've got such expectations for a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. And there's a couple of directors who, like, their cinematic beginnings, their directorial debuts, their early films were at a time when I was learning to love movies. And I mean, the number one director for that is Quentin Tarantino. When I saw Reservoir Dogs, that was it. You know, that this is my guy, this is my director, I can't wait to see every single Quentin Tarantino movie he ever makes. And Paul Thomas Anderson comes on along a bit later, and he's your thinking man's Quentin Tarantino. I saw Boogie Nights first, because Hard Eight, as it's known in this country, or it's Sydney in America, that didn't really get much of a release in Aylesbury. But as soon as Boogie Nights came out, I was chasing down Hard Eight on video. So I'm on board these fledgling directors, and I can't wait to see what they do next. Same with who else is there? There's like, I don't know, like Shane Carruth. I'd say Yorgos Lanthimos to a lesser extent, like going to see Dogtooth in the cinema when I was more like, it was in my mid-20s. I think Denis Villeneuve as well. But he had made one foreign film which I hadn't seen. But when he came over with Enemy,
That's just was right in my wheelhouse, and it's like, oh great, I've got a foreign director now who's mine. I want to see this guy's films, every single one of them. And so that sort of changes the relationship with the movies that come out, that they release. Christopher Nolan, I forgot Sir Christopher Nolan, he toppled Tarantino. And I mean, that's the thing. So yeah, Tarantino, he sort of starts to fade away, and my relationship with him starts to feel more a bit deflated and disappointed. And it's not Quentin Tarantino's fault. He wants to make his movies the way he wants to make them. But after Jackie Brown failed, and then he launched himself into the Kill Bills, every subsequent film for that I've been less and less interested by. He's big into his Grindhouse, and he seemed to lose important collaborators who seemed to be able to steer him away from his worst instincts. And now he does whatever he wants, and so there's what I want. I want Quentin Tarantino to make the kind of Quentin Tarantino movie that I want to see, and he doesn't do that anymore. And then so in comes these other ones. In comes Sir Christopher Nolan, seeing Memento. Again, I've spoken about that, how it a really formative film, seeing that at the cinema. I was at university, and maybe there are other previous films that would have done that, but it's that have played with structure and all that kind of gubbins. I'm not saying he reinvented the wheel, but for me it was like Nolan's done this. And then every subsequent film I'm growing with Nolan, and I'm now I want a Christopher Nolan movie. And then that starts to again hamper how I can enjoy a Christopher Nolan movie. I didn't really like Oppenheimer, because by the time he comes out with Oppenheimer, that's like the least Christopher Nolan movie there is for me. I'm like, there's no jiggery pokery really, and it's just a very straight sort of telling of a guy who invented the atom bomb. I'm like, oh, why is that? Come on, Chris, do something with time again. But then I rewatched that. Give it 2 years, and I realized, Jesus, this is unbelievably entertaining and engaging. How he's managed to tell a story about a guy who invents the atom bomb. It's fantastic. And yeah, it was winding me up at the time how much everyone was loving Oppenheimer. I was like, what are you talking about? This is crazy. And, you know, I came back and I ate some humble pie. But I'm recording this a day before The Odyssey comes out. And I've got my ticket. I'm seeing it tomorrow. I don't think I could possibly enjoy it. I'm not going to be able to enjoy it. It's going to be not the thing I want or not the thing I expect. And then I'm going to have to rewatch it. That's what I'm talking about. That kind of director, the kind of director that you grow up with and that you kind of follow their journey. And Paul Thomas Anderson is one of those for me as well, even though I say I hopped on with Boogie Nights. And yeah, and then would struggle with Magnolia. But he's this really interesting indie director back then. And he does Punch Drunk Love, and that's 90 minutes. And I remember loving that. But then, and I think for a lot of people, this will be the case. When he comes out with There Will Be Blood in 2007... suddenly you're like, okay, this is what he's been building up to. This is a Paul Thomas Anderson movie. This is a PTA movie. Phenomenal flick. I haven't rewatched that in so long. I can't wait to pop it back on, just talking about it. And everything I love about There Will Be Blood are why I do not is lacking in one battle after another. Which I will say, I'll just tease. I did really enjoy watching One Battle After Another. So I'm going to say some nice things about it, but I didn't love it. And then seeing The Master, that The Master comes out 5 years later, you're waiting for a PTA flick. Come on, PTA. Bosh out a flick. But he doesn't do that. 5 years. And then all the chat is he's making this Scientology movie. Isn't that interesting? Oh, he worked with Tom Cruise. It turns out it's nothing like that, but I remember going to see the 70 mil in the Odeon Leicester Square, which is no longer there now. and just the excitement that had been building over 5 years of like, what is the next film this guy's, what is he going to make? What can he do? And The Master is, I mean, at the time I would say I thought it was a masterpiece. Again, I haven't rewatched that in a long time. I might double bill it with There Will Be Blood. Just amazing. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Joaquin's never been better. It's really odd. The score is like odd. The score is so jarring. It's probably, I remember struggling towards the end, sort of slightly losing patience with it. But yeah, it's fantastic. And then what, we're waiting another, oh, it's only 2 years later. You see, 2 years later, this is where things change. He maybe hurries it. He hurries it and he does Inherent Vice, which I did rewatch in preparation for this, which I remember watching it at the time and being thoroughly, bored's the wrong word, but struggling to watch that, confused, bored. And on the rewatch, cranking up the volume and putting the subtitles on was very useful because I could see and hear what people were saying. It's very, very hard to follow. It's a vibes movie, and I don't think it's about anything, and I don't think it's got interesting characters. I don't want to hang out with it. It's a movie that wants you to hang out with it. And all these kinds of Thomas, it's based on a Thomas Pynchon novel. And the things he's taken from that, this Pynchon stuff is going to come back in one battle after another, because that's also inspired by another Pynchon. And then he leaves it 5 years. It's that 5 year gap. And he bounces back with Phantom Thread, which is quite a silly, overblown film, but then also it's so compelling and odd. I don't quite buy the ending, but there's something fascinating about the relationship between Daniel Day-Lewis and Vicky Creeps. Only seen that twice, and I think that's certainly like a fun little oddity. Impressive oddity for Paul Thomas Anderson. And then again, we're waiting. Maybe 5 years isn't the magic. Okay, it's 4 years. 4 years later, and Licorice Pizza is just, it's a three-star, nothing of a movie, really. I don't believe any of these people. I don't believe the relationships. It's another vibes movie. It's kind of got Rushmore vibes, this kid hustling around. I guess very personal, inspired by PTA, hanging out LA, growing up. It's perfectly likable, but there's just nothing to it, I don't think. And then it's 5 years later. We're four years later, and it's one battle after another. So that's my PT Anderson journey. But before I talk about my rewatching One Battle After Another, it occurred to me that there's not just the directors that you grow up with, you know, that you kind of fall in love with and you grow with them, kind of like a first love. I start to sort of think of it like this is the first love of your life, and it hurts when that ends, Quentin, looking at you. But then there's also, you've also got the directors that you join like mid journey. They're mid journey. I mean, so like I was thinking like Scorsese, Spielberg, the Coens, Steven Soderbergh, Michael Mann, John Carpenter, John McTiernan. Like you're joining these directors like mid to late their career. And your start, wherever you start with them is whichever flicker in their oeuvre, love that word, that you start with. You've got the joy of going through their whole catalogue without any expectation, really. Yeah, I mean, even with Scorsese, like you start with Taxi Driver. I started with Taxi Driver. It's quite a heavy, intense film. And then you're like, that's a bit much. I found that a bit much. I didn't really get it. It would take me quite a few years to rewatch that and then get it. And then, you know, hop to Goodfellas and you're like, oh, okay, this is great. Problem is when you watch Goodfellas, you sort of then want all of his movies to be Goodfellas. But, you know, then you've got Raging Bull, hop to that. And then, you know, you chance upon After Hours and King of Comedy. You're seeing all the different speeds of Scorsese. It just feels like you can get less hung up on what you need from this kind of director. I guess the only problem is now is when you kind of get through their filmography and then they start releasing new movies as you're watching. So now I do have expectations of a Scorsese movie when a new one comes out. I didn't like Killers of a Flower Moon. I thought it was oppressive and dull and not my cup of tea at all. Leo, another Leo movie. One battle after another. They speak to a very particular period, I'd say, that Leo's operating in. And Spielberg as well. I've been nothing but disappointed with Spielberg for a good couple of decades now. Coens are fine. It's a shame they've stopped doing movies. So they're like old flames. You know, if the first set of directors are young love, these ones are old flames. And then I was like, oh, there's a whole other set. There's a whole set of dead ones. You've got Dead Husbands, you know, Alfred Hitchcock, Ingmar Bergman, Stanley Kubrick, Sergio Leone, Kurosawa. You know, the directors you started with when they're dead, they're slightly trickier than the other directors you join mid-journey, mid-career. Because all of those directors, they're sort of overloaded with prestige and expectation and acclaim. It sort of goes back to my Seventh Seal chat with those. I think the thing with those kinds of directors, you've got to get them young. You've got to watch them young before you've read too much, before you get overloaded with, like, you've got to see this, you've got to see that. So that's my theory. I think as I get older... I realise that I'm not taking on any new directors, like, in the same way that I did. I've stopped making friends, but like any kind of new directors at the start of their careers, I'm not taking them on and getting excited and following them. Like, I'm not into the Safdies. I couldn't care less about them. Like, Sean Baker, ditto. Jordan Peele, as much fun as I had with Get Out, you know, I didn't hitch my wagon to Peele, and I'm very glad I didn't, because every subsequent film he's made to Get Out, which is fantastic, has been less and less interesting. And I'm certainly not signing up with Curry Barker and Kane Parsons. You know, I'm excited maybe that there is, you know, there'll be 15 to 25-year-old film fans those are their guys, and they'll get excited by every movie they make. I'm not doing that anymore. I'm never going to be attached to like a new director. And so, I mean, which is a silver lining, because I don't have any expectation for those movies. Maybe that's why I quite enjoyed Mighty Supreme, although I haven't thought about it for a second since I watched it. I enjoyed Mighty Supreme because I had zero hopes or expectation for it. I mean, I'd love to know who your first love directors are. You know, the ones that you feel are yours, you know, you joined as they were starting making their first movies. You should join the Discord, you know, link in the channel, or email us at moviesyouforgot. And like, who are the directors that broke your heart? Again, for me, it's Quentin Tarantino. Who was the last film director you fell in love with? I'm trying to think who mine would have been. I put The Walls up so hard after Tarantino. I'll obviously let Nolan in. I'd say maybe Denis Villeneuve, but never like a deep thing, more like a fuck buddy. A horrible term, sorry. It feels like Chris Nolan has become something of like, is this like embarrassing partner whose behaviour I seemingly have to account for? He comes in for so much shit. And PTA, I think we were just pals. you know, all he kept me going, he teased me along, but it turned out he had his eyes on other things all the while. The things I thought he was interested in, he wasn't, you know, really. He was he had a battered copy of every Thomas Pynchon novel in his back pocket, you know. Waffly Pynchon.
You've come here and you've brought good and wealth, but you have also brought your bad habits as a backslider. You've lusted after women and you have abandoned your child. Your child that you raised, you have abandoned all because he was sick and you have sinned. So say it now. I am a sinner. Say it louder. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
Louder, Daniel. I am a sinner.
I am a sinner.
I am sorry, Lord.
I am sorry, Lord.
I want the blood.
I want the blood.
You have abandoned your child.
I've abandoned my child.
I will never backslide.
I will never backslide.
I was lost, but now I am found.
I was lost, but now I'm found.
I have abandoned my child.
I've abandoned my child.
Say it louder. Say it louder.
I've abandoned my child. I've abandoned my child. I've abandoned my boy.
Beg for the blood!
Give me the blood, Lord, and let me get away!
Do you accept Jesus Christ as your saviour?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, to one battle, what did Joe think I'd say? Yeah, I hated Sean Penn in it first time round. I thought he was ludicrous. I started to appreciate his performance a lot more. He plays the part. I think what I realised is I hate the character and I don't believe the character, because as it turns out, what he wants, I just find ludicrous. Spoiler alert, he wants to track down the love child between him and Perfidia Beverly Hills and kill her, because he wants to enter a secret racist society, and Perfidia Beverly Hills is, she's black, she's Teyonah Taylor, and the daughter, Willa, played by Chase Infinity, she's proof of his dalliance. So I could never get on board with that bit of the story. But rewatching it, it bugged me a lot less. It's just the movie. That's what the story is, and it sort of doesn't really matter. I hadn't enjoyed the opening, and then I did. I quite liked the first 15 minutes. It just kind of gets going. And it kind of, that opening section sort of peters out a bit, I'd say. It feels quite stuttery. It seems very silly how Sean Penn's Lockjaw and Perfidia, Teyonah Taylor's Perfidia Beverly Hills get together in their relationship. But then the whole middle section of the movie, when you jump ahead, is pretty great. Leo is he's this sort of stoner guy. He's a fuck-up and a stoner, and him on the run is very amusing. And it does, it rattles along. This flick, as Joe said, is very entertaining. And then by the end, when you've got the chase sequence in the car in the desert, you know, it's just, it is superb, superbly done. It's so tense. The score's fantastic. And, you know, it's all paying off. And it's great. This is when the movie is exactly what I want it to be. And so, you know, it's hard to like, all the nitpicks that I had just, you know, all just fade away. It's a beautifully made film. I think the why I don't love it is I just don't care about anyone in it. I don't believe anyone is a real person. Leo is doing good work, but his character is barely a character. I think he's quite one-dimensional. But enough of that. Okay, I think let's I'll give my score out of 100, and then let's see if Joe can guess what my score was. I know it seems like I've been really down on it. I mean, I've mainly talked about types of directors. This is such an unequivocally, undeniably, wonderfully made movie. And the chase sequence in particular is phenomenal. It's impossible to give this flick anything lower than an 80. And I know it feels like an 80 would be a film I also love. But let's say films that the film, if I loved it, I'd give it 84 and above. So yeah, this is 80. I admire it. I'm giving it 80.
Okay. What do I think Adam thought of this movie out of 100? Well, he's going to struggle to give it less than a 70. I'll say that. Now, the question is, how negatively will he feel about it? If it's negative, it will be below 75. If he's somewhat softened, it could be above 75. So to play it safe, I'm just going to straight up say 75. That's what I'm guessing. I'm sitting on the fence a little bit. But Adam, how close was I?
Oh, how those splinters up your bum, Joe. Sat on the fence over there on 75. No, mate, you're plumb wrong. Okay, you thought too little of me, didn't you? You know, I said 80. It's an 80. I have softened on it. You know, because I've been on a journey. It's been one bloody battle after another. You know, trying to fight back against the people who think I just don't like stuff because everyone likes it, or, you know, my opinion's wrong. I was thinking about, like, you and your cohorts on the TIFO stream the other night. You were talking about Titanic. Titanic came up, and one of your cohorts said, oh, you know, it's a really good movie, that. He really liked it. And you went in two-footed on Titanic, as you should have. I couldn't believe anyone would say nice things about that movie. And so, yeah, you're like, is it just because someone likes something? And a lot of people really like Titanic. I don't know if you know this, Joe. It was one of the biggest box office smashes of that year, cleaned up at the Oscars, and people loved it. They really, really loved it. And I thought it was, I remember seeing it at the cinema, and my main memory is of the car scene. Kate Winslet unrobing. I remember just being really surprised at that bit because it was a 12. It felt like a gift in that regard. But it's a very long, very basic movie. Some of the CGI is dated quite badly. But if you think it, like, I've always believed that a film, you've got to judge it on its own terms. And if that's true, you judge Titanic on its own terms. What is Titanic? It's a romance and it's a disaster flick. Now, on each of those bases, like in terms of a romance, it's broad and obvious and trite, but that's what a romance, most romance movies are. Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio have pretty good chemistry. She does feel like his mum in that movie. Do you know what I mean? She does feel like his mum. Oh, again, maybe that's just me. maybe I feel like she's my mum. Maybe it's probably an okay romance. And then in terms of a disaster flick, I can't remember anything about it, but it must be pretty well done if James Cameron directed it. Yes, some of the boat CGI is ropey. So on its own terms, Titanic is a good movie. We just think it's rubbish. And it pains me to say that, but yeah, like when it comes to wanting things from a movie, I'd never put on Titanic because I know it would never give me what I want. Back to PTA, he's always, I think he's going to struggle to give me what I want whenever I see a new movie of his. I want him to go back to There Will Be Blood and do something like that again. Quentin Tarantino, I want you to go back and make more movies like Jackie Brown. I want Christopher Nolan to go back and make more movies like smaller movies, like Insomnia and The Prestige and Memento. Denis Villeneuve, I want you to go back. I want you to make movies like Enemy and Arrival. I mean, Arrival's a massive movie, but that's what I want. I think what I'm saying is a roundabout way of saying Joe doesn't understand me or where I'm coming from when I don't enjoy a movie like this, because he hasn't been on the same journey as me. He hasn't got the same relationship with this kind of, with the director that I do. And maybe this is the only way I can tell him. You know, this is what it means when you start a relationship with a director, a fledgling one in particular. It means something. And I was there, you know, I was there when Tarantino came onto the scene. I was there when PTA came onto the scene. I was there when Nolan came onto the scene. And I've formed bonds and a relationship with them. And so it's different for me. It's easier for Joe to sit on the sidelines and just watch a movie on its own terms. He doesn't care about Paul Thomas Anderson. He said he doesn't even like him as a filmmaker. So he'll just sit. He can sit down and watch one battle after another and be entertained by it. What a wonderful head to live in. His big leaky bucket, completely unencumbered with expectation. I wonder what does he have? Any relationships? Does he have any feelings? Any hopes or dreams? What, you know, he doesn't want anything from a movie either. He's like the ideal viewer in many regards. And I'm not, you know, I've got a void inside. I'm chasing and I'm reaching and I'm hoping. I guess it's kind of like football in a way. Young football fans, they've stopped following teams and they now follow players because they won't get hurt, you know, that way. If you follow Messi, he's always going to win. You know, your team, even if the team loses, you follow the best guy and he did something amazing. And I don't have much respect for that at all. The thing that you can get from watching football is a very, very rare moment of joy. But to get that rare moment, it means you have to suffer. You know, I respect the lower league football fan because they suffer. And then every once in a million years, something magic happens. That's why it's a great being an England fan. It's all about suffering in tiny little moments, snatched moments of joy. And then to swiftly be followed by, oh no, it's all been ripped away from me again. How does that relate to directors? I guess when you hook on to a director, you're investing in the movies that the director is going to come out. And then when they're there, when they finally come out, that expectation is part of the experience. And so then if your hopes are dashed, they're dashed, but then also they can be, you're invested, you're emotionally invested. And so you could end up with a greater payout. I think that's my point. Anyway, just, you know, Joe doesn't get it. You know, who's the director that he grew up with? Peter Jackson? That's more of the, but that's not him. Those are just the Lord of the Ring movies. He doesn't care about Chris Columbus and, you know, he cares about Harry Potter. What does that mean then? I like directors and he likes films. Films are more like teams, aren't they? So then maybe I'm more like the thing I hate. And he's the better fan because he likes teams/films. Okay, that's it. Let's wrap it up. Thanks for having me. I'm really enjoying this series. Maybe one day I'll do a You Made Me Watch. You know, listeners pitch a movie that you want me to watch and you tell me why. You tell me what score you think I'd give it, and then I do that. You know, it just depends. It depends how these episodes go down. All right, bye.
Hello.
Hello. Is that Naomi?
Naomi.
Yeah, Naomi. Is that? It's Kong.
Kong.
King Kong.
Sorry, I'm just trying to think if I know any Kong.
We worked on a movie together about
about 20 years ago.
Oh, darling, I'm sorry. I've worked on many films. Can you narrow it down or describe yourself?
Well, I think I'm fairly memorable. Peter Jackson directed.
Mm.
We worked with Adrian Brody and...
Oh, yes, I remember that. That on the island. Which one were you?
Well, I was the titular character, Kong.
Oh, Kong!
You don't
Kong.
Remember? Kong, I'm, yeah, you do, aren't
yeah,
you?
Kong, I remember. Yeah, you were the boatman, weren't you? One of the boat people?
No, I don't like to talk about myself this way, but I was the big giant ape.
Oh, Kong, silly me, of course you're the giant ape, I'm sorry. I don't know what came over me. Of course I remember you, darling. How are you? It's been a long time.
Well, a lot of people, it's unfortunate, a lot of people, the rumours were going around that Andy Serkis had done his ping pong thing.
Right, yeah.
And that's how they shot the movie.
Yeah, no, I understand. I mean, you're scarcely believable, aren't you, really, with how big you are and everything. So I think I could you sort of have to understand why audiences might feel that way, but... Must be very annoying for people to think that you're you are controlled by Andy Serkis.
Yeah, or represented by him. I think that's also that kind of explains why I sort of struggled to get parts in the subsequent years. It's partly why I was calling.
Right. Yeah. The problem, I suppose, I was going to say that actually. One of the problems for you, I suppose, would be that you know there's really only one role that you are appropriate for in Hollywood cinema. Because, you know, you're a giant ape. So I would say I fully support the notion, be it woke or not, that you shouldn't have people who aren't giant apes playing giant apes. So that does leave a big window of opportunity for you whenever a Kong film comes around. But also, it's hard to not have that and have the inverse of it, isn't it? Like, you can play Kong, but can you play Waiter Number 4? I mean, it's difficult when you don't fit in the building.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm a pretty good actor. If you remember from the movie, we have some lovely moments. Yeah. There's a bit where you believe that, you know, we've kind of fallen in love ice skating on a frozen lake in New York. Very strange scene. Very strange scene, but you really buy it because of me.
It is strange, but I would say that a lot of... actually, you were very good, but also I was bringing quite a lot to that scene. And... You know, people. To be honest, Kong, I don't want to rake up old stuff, but I was a little bit upset after that film because there were a lot of people, weren't there, that were saying, "Oh, isn't his face fantastic? It's for his face is so expressive. Kong's face is so expressive." And I remember thinking, "What about my face? What about old Naomi's face? My face is expressive as well." But no one was saying it because. When I was doing actually very advanced human face acting and nobody said a fucking thing about my face. It was all about your face. And actually, what about me? You know? And here you are now, you're calling me all these years later and you're talking about your own performance. You haven't said a damn thing about mine.
You didn't even remember my name. I thought you were fantastic. I loved you in
that
picture.
Well, thanks for saying it now.
You were so... What do you mean now? You didn't even remember who I was. I called you up and you thought I was the fucking... You know, the ship's mate.
I do a lot of movies, Kong. I'm not like you.
We can see how I'd be wounded by that. And like what, I'm suddenly going to bounce back and go, oh, by the way, you don't remember me, but you were amazing in that movie. I'm reaching out because, you know, I'm running low on bananas. I'm struggling. Right. All right?
Firstly, I'll say I'm sorry.
Apology
right.
accepted.
I think I've been a bit. I've gone a bit Hollywood, haven't I? But I'm not. I'm deeper than that, Kong. But I did have a question, actually, of curiosity, if you don't mind me asking.
Mm.
And you probably get this a lot. So, look, I'll just be straight up. It's a question about about how big you are and stuff.
Is it about my penis?
No.
Oh, good. Sorry, that is the one I always get. I've got so much porn work. After that, and I wanted to be bigger than that, and I was bigger than that, and I said no, much to the chagrin of my accountant.
Your accountant wanted you to do porn.
They wanted to hire me in King Kong's dong. They wanted to hire me for King Kong's Dong 2.
Yeah.
King Kong's Ding Dong, Ding Dong.
What about Kongalicious?
Yeah.
Thong Kong.
Kong in a thong. You know, they pitched, they threw pun after pun after pun.
And you said no.
And of course I did. I'm a serious actor.
You're a serious actor.
Everyone was talking about that movie for about 5 seconds after it came out. Yeah. And then it got, you know, again, you were fantastic. I quite liked Adrian Brody in it too. I think he's quite nice.
He's fine. He was fine. He's gone off the rails a little bit. But I was actually going to ask you, are there giant bananas that sort of on your island that kind of match your size? Or do you have to eat like 1,000 bananas a day or something? Because I know they're quite high in calorific content, but not for... Well, how many calories do you have to eat a day?
I mean, it's a lot. But again, you know...
Do you not know how many?
No, I do know, but... I wouldn't say, but also I think I chatted to Peter Jackson about, the director. I said he just wanted me to eat lots of tiny bananas because he thought that would be quite funny and heartwarming. Yeah. And I said, Peter, I'm a massive ape. I need protein. I need meat on a lot of it.
And he said, eat meat?
Yeah, yeah. I eat a lot. You know, I'm a bloodthirsty ape in the movie and also in real life. But
how do you eat in real life, like, to sustain your life?
Well, this is what I said to Peter. I said, Peter, you know, I'm familiar with giant bugs and prehistoric creatures. You know, get them in. Get in creatures of similar size. And then it starts to make sense. And he said...
That explains all the union issues.
The union issues?
Yeah, do you not remember how the union kept getting involved? Because... the bug union, because they said that the working conditions were unsafe because you kept eating the actors.
Well, yeah, Peter, you know, doesn't have the film is quite notable in that regard. It doesn't have the Peter, bit of blurb at the end. You know, this movie was made with Peter and the animal overseeing association who made sure that there were no animals hurt in the making.
Oh, Peter, as in P-E-T-A. I thought you were talking about Peter Jackson still.
No, I was talking about Peter, the kid from Hunger Games. He oversees all the oversees all the animal harm stuff. And
didn't know that.
Yeah, and that's how I do it. You know, it's eating large beasts and bugs. Bugs is quite nutritious.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I tell you what, the problem with that, though, when I did... I think the banana sequence in his original script would have been like a passing moment. The problem with when I told him about the bugs and the dinosaurs, his eyes lit up and it ended up adding a whole hour and a half to the movie, which no one wanted, not even me.
No, it was too long, wasn't it, in retrospect? But I think it's better than people give it credit for. Obviously, we would say that because we were in it. But I think there was some disappointment at the time. But actually, I've seen it back a few times on TV now and then. And I've thought, that's, in comparison to some other things that are made, that's not bad. That's okay.
Yeah, I think it's quite compelling. But like, do you not think there's some stylistic choices that Peter made? Like, there's this really odd kind of slow-mo zoom effect that he keeps throwing in.
That's his favourite thing, though. You can't make, Peter Jackson can't make a film without putting that in there. It's his trademark. It's part of his legacy, and listen, I'm fine with accepting it. You know, it works in Lord of the Rings.
It doesn't work here, though. It doesn't work here.
Yeah, it works. It's fine. It's fine.
What did you think about how he depicted the indigenous peoples of the island? Because I'm friends with those people, and that's not how they look or dress. And he kind of they're just like, you know, regular Joe Schmo and Jill Schmo.
Ah, they were so good at that. I really thought they were legit.
Well, yeah, he made them look like savages. I found it quite offensive. I'm surprised no one said at the time or since how horribly offensive it was.
Well, I mean, it was just very convincing, wasn't it? So I think the thing is, when it seems real, it doesn't feel offensive.
Is that the criteria? Because at the time, I was a young, fledgling actor. I didn't want to bring anything up. But you were just thinking, this feels so real, it can't be offensive.
Well, I just thought, well, Peter's found some tribes people, hasn't he? I mean, this is fantastic. He's found this giant gorilla ape, that's you, and also he's found all of these very very authentic island people, and I believe that they have built this big wall to guard from you.
Yeah, but then I get out so easily. So what have I been? Hang on a sec. Right, hang on. Mm-hmm. What came first, me, Kong, or the wall? And also, when you meet these people, they're all withering, like withered people. They couldn't fucking like build a fire, let alone this amazing feat of engineering and wood.
I'd say it probably pre-existed them, a bit like the wall in Game of Thrones, because we see in the film the skulls of your forefathers, of your ancestors.
How many fathers?
Four of them,
I've only got one father. Huh?
Very droll. You should forget about porn. You should be doing stand-up comedy.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, I've got a tight five about small bananas.
Yeah. You wouldn't need a microphone either, because you've got really big, big speech pipes, vocal box. Anyway, what I was saying was, we know that your forefathers were there before you. We also know that there's these big dinosaurs and bugs and stuff. So I expect that the ancestors of the tribespeople also built the wall, and it's been there for a very, very long time. I'm not that bothered by that kind of stuff, to be honest. Why are you calling me?